You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 28th of August to the 3rd of September 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and David Matthews, Deputy News Editor John Morgan and Books Editor Karen Shook. Coming up in today's podcast, could thousands of pounds in tuition fee loans have gone to a private college that failed its first quality assurance agency inspection? More on that shortly. Staying with student loan money, what will happen to students who had places at one of the private colleges that have had their right to receive public funding removed by the government? Could another private provider offer them an alternative? We'll hear the answer to that soon. And Karen is here to give us the lowdown on our ever-popular books section. Before finally, David joins us, one, because it's his last week on the higher, and two, because we couldn't let him go without saying a little bit about the work he's been doing on the Scottish independence referendum. Not on either of the campaigns, I hasten to add, but some research into academics' opinions of it. But Jack, first, it's not often, is it, that the QAA delivers a no-confidence verdict when assessing an institution, but that's what's happened at the London Oriental Academy.
Yes, it is very rare, actually, to have this, what is actually quite a damning verdict on your institution. This is a place called the London Oriental Academy. It's situated off East Ham High Street, and it's been a further education provider for many years, and it's only recently just got won the right to gain student loan company money to take on students who have student loans. And as such, the Quality Assurance Agency wanted to have a look at what was being offered, and they were actually quite critical of what was going on here. Just quickly on QAA reports, you don't actually have a sort of inspector in the classroom. They want to see, like you do in Ofsted, they want to see what your paperwork is like, what your record keeping is, showing you records of how well you're doing and performing and trying to improve and how you're checking standards. And they found basically that this place wasn't really doing any of the things in the way that it should be doing. And as a result, the student loan company suspended all payments to students at this place. And I mean, it's interesting really, because we don't cover FE colleges that much in the Times Higher, but this is interesting because it's getting student loan company money, which generally goes to universities, and there have long been concerns whether there was enough scrutiny on these places that are now receiving thousands of pounds worth of taxpayer backed loans.
Yeah.
And the academy itself said that it's been hard done to, and they've tried very hard to get things right. And they were very surprised because they've really tried hard to abide by the rules, but the QAA has been pretty damning in its judgment.
Mm. And it's interesting, isn't it, that none of the current HEIs in the UK have a no-confidence ruling hanging over them. I think one or two maybe have had the next rung down of
a
warning.
Yeah, a few have had limited confidence judgments, but only one higher education institution, sort of a university, has ever received a no confidence judgment a long time ago, and I won't say what it was because it was a very long time ago, but it's almost unheard of to have it for a university, and even for colleges it's very rare. So to have an institution have a no confidence verdict on its academic standards and its learning opportunities and the information that it provides to students is quite rare.
Well, it's pretty rare to be marked down this badly by the QAA. But you're the QAA expert. But when I first started reporting on HE, I was quite surprised that the QAA, worth pointing out again, it doesn't actually necessarily assure the quality of degree standards or the difficulty of getting a qualification. It's more a sort of bureaucratic check and more kind of about processes.
Yeah.
So, you can argue that you know, even what it's assessing here and has found wanting here isn't necessarily exactly what you want to be assessing about a university. We've got no idea, really, what the, you know, what the quality of the teaching is. As you say, it's not like Ofsted at all.
Yeah, it doesn't. It doesn't. They don't sit in. I mean, basically, it would be too unwieldy to have basically an inspector sitting in every single classroom of every single subject, saying, "Is this up to scratch?"
So tell teachers that
it's
in
a
high
very,
school.
It's a very light touch regime. And maybe, as we're seeing, with when you're not dealing with universities with decades of higher education experience, maybe you need a sort of maybe a heavier touch, if that's an expression, form of regulation.
I'm sure so listeners would be delighted to hear that recommendation.
The private college that the Guardian did an expose on, the London School of Science and Technology, where the Guardian said there were empty classrooms and students were calling it the ATM College, that passed through its QAA inspections with no problems. So it shows you've really got to go some to get no confidence from the QAA. So it does suggest that things have gone wrong, but there have been, you know, plenty of criticisms about the QAA's scrutiny of private colleges and suggestions that they really sort of haven't introduced the inspection regime that is necessary to accompany the massive expansion in student numbers and public funding at these institutions.
Mm. Interesting stuff. Well, you don't want to draw too many any lines at all, of course, between that Guardian expose and the school in Jack's story. But the full story is there to be read on page 8. I should mention our lead news story this week concerns the QAA as well. It's a look into accusations of preferential treatment for students sponsored by the Saudi Arabian government at one university in the south of England. I won't tell you more than that on this, but you can read that on page 6 and 7 this week. And, of course, at timeshighereducation.co.uk. Now, John, sticking with sort of student loan money, I guess, was a sort of vague link there. The government stripped a number of private colleges of the right to access public funding, and it's enlisted a pretty well-known name to try and find a new home for some of the students that will be affected by that.
So the wave of expansion of private colleges under the current government, most of the colleges have used a qualification run by, awarded by Pearson. It's called High National Certificate and
of course, yeah.
High National Diplomas. So they've gone via this route rather than offering degrees that are validated by universities, and some, plenty of observers would say that it's rather easier for these colleges to offer the HNDs and HNCs because then there may be sort of a slightly lower level of scrutiny, perhaps, some would suggest. But it looks like now the government has said that it's going to remove permission for some private colleges to access public funding for their students for the coming year. And it's said to Pearson that Pearson should help find new colleges for any students who will need to transfer as a result, and Pearson confirmed that it's helping BIS with a contingency plan for any students who won't be able to start their courses if their chosen college doesn't obtain designation. And it's all a bit up in the air at the moment because BIS won't confirm how many colleges they've removed designation from and which ones they are.
So we don't know how many students would be in this situation.
Exactly, but sort of sources have suggested to me that Pearson have been saying that there could be up to 6,000 displaced students looking for new courses in London alone. But I guess one of the reasons why things aren't certain is because the colleges that have been told they might lose designation have challenged it with BIS and possibly even threatened BIS with legal action, and maybe BIS are sort of less than confident in the robustness of this designation framework that they have, so possibly they're quite nervous about those legal challenges. So it's going on until a very late stage ahead of the new academic year.
Why Pearson? Why have they been roped in to do the government's work for them, or acting in some kind of quasi industry body way?
So because Pearson award the qualifications that are used by the colleges,
they make
that
money
expand
from
the fast,
running these qualifications.
The fastest, yeah. Pearson get paid by these colleges for every student who takes one of the courses. So you might think that the government has said to Pearson, well, you have some involvement in this expansion, so would you like to help us sort of deal with with some of the consequences from some of the colleges who've proved not to be too sound on quality.
It's easy to get caught up, isn't it, when the government strips providers of that right with you know the reasons that has happened and forget about the students that it actually affects and
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
who did take those courses very, very seriously and now have nowhere to go.
For those students who won't be able to study where they thought they were going to, it's obviously a really pressing situation.
Thanks, John. Karen, let's move along to the books section. No doubt a bumper crop.
It's a plethora.
A plethora this week. What's in store?
Susan Greenfield, the noted neuroscientist, has a new book out called Mind Change: How Digital Technologies Are Leaving Their Mark on Our Brains. This is a book that many people would see as being in the same area as Mark Prensky's work on digital natives, i.e. that young people, because they've got tablets and smartphones, are quite different to old people who are only just working out email. People like Andrew Keane with The Cult of the Amateur. Tara Brabazon, a regular contributor to our pages, who's written widely on this field, changes in education brought about by the digital age, takes on the book and believes that Greenfield is falling into the same trap as many of those other people and not considering the literature and the body of research in education improving performance in the classroom, but merely seeing the digital world as something completely unprecedented, and it will strip away any of the things we already know about how students are taught or what the factors are, and that it's just completely different. So Tara is quite skeptical about the book. It's an extremely high-profile book. The argument that our brains really are changing when it's being made by someone who's a neuroscientist is obviously very convincing. But Tara points out that there was a large involvement by a doctoral student who Susan Greenfield brought in after she'd written the body of the book. That's not unusual to have someone at that level as your research assistant in a book like that. But Tara suggests that perhaps Greenfield is writing something that's more of a polemic or an opinion piece rather than something informed by research. She has a different perspective, obviously. Also, this week, talking about the nature of monographs and scholarly research and how sometimes things can go astray, we've got an interesting review by Nigel Rodenhurst, who is a Philip Roth scholar, about a book by Patrick Hayes, also a Philip Roth scholar. Now, you would think that would be grounds for, I don't know, loggerheads at dawn. But Rodenhurst's position about Patrick Hayes' book, Philip Roth, Fiction and Power, is that it's indicative of what can happen when a literary figure, be he or she still alive or not, has reached a certain level of influence and importance in the canon, in the literary world, that academics often really struggle to find something trenchant to say about them. Obviously, if you choose someone as your object of study, it may be because you think they're fantastic. But also, if you get funding to go research at the archives for that author, for example, it's very difficult to say things that might be critical of the author's position. Obviously, Philip Roth has drawn fire, in particular, from feminist scholars. And Rodenhurst says this is one of those kind of books where a scholar inadvertently falls prey to this sort of respectful hesitancy to criticize. So you just find yourself saying, gosh, aren't these wonderful books? And making sure that nobody's crossed that you've had funding to spend all this time at a set of archives. And then, you know, I'm sure it would not be well viewed if you then used it to say, Philip Roth, oh my goodness, he was dreadful. So it's an interesting issue for scholars in that case. We also have Farzana Sheikh from the Royal Institute of International Affairs this week reviewing Amin Saikal's book, Zone of Crisis, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and Iraq. She points out this is an incredibly useful study, but says part of the problem is that this work, done by scholars with expertise in the area, tends not to be seen by the policymakers who really need to be reading it to find out what's going on the ground. I've no idea how much scholarly monographs get into the hands of those sorts of people, but you can imagine scholars in the field feeling that it hasn't sunk through quite as far as it should. Also this week, Murray Smith is reviewing Philosophy and Blade Runner by Timothy Shanahan. So for all of those of you who watched that movie once or several times and thought it was really deep,
love it.
We've got someone thinking about how it's really deep. And our book of the week this week, reviewed by Bill Perdue, A.W. Perdue from Northumbria University, is Richard Vinen's National Service, Conscription in Britain, 1945 to 1963. A lot of people feel this has been quite a neglected area of 20th century history. Obviously, 2 million conscripts pulled in to serve their country and, some would argue, sort out their own problems between 1945 and 1963. And there really hasn't been the weight of scholarship on it. Certainly the author, Vinen, who's a professor of history at King's College, says that's not true. There have been some valuable books. But part of the reason he thinks that, you know, popular attention hasn't been focused on it is the generation before, obviously, having lived through the Second World War. And more to the point, he said to me, a vociferous generation of baby boomers who came of age right after National Service, and they often assume that the history of post-war Britain is the history of their lives. And to hear them talk, you would think that events at King's Parade in 1968 were only marginally less important than the ones in Petrograd in 1917.
Very good. And while we've got you here, you interviewed recently Sally Feldman and Laurie Taylor, of course, for the latest in your a series of books, podcasts.
That's
it's still available on the podcast page where you found this one, on iTunes, as ever. Was that enjoyable?
Two big names in our pages. Laurie Taylor, obviously the author of The Poppletonian, yeah, and a contributor for many years. Sally Feldman, former Dean of Media Arts and Culture at the University of Westminster and a columnist. And for a number of years, they've been working on a television series called In Confidence, where celebrities are interviewed. Of course, as a sociologist and a media studies scholar, they realize that perhaps unlike other people in broadcast journalism, all this data shouldn't be over once it had been broadcast. And they thought, let's take it away and sit down and think about the idea of celebrity. And Laurie Taylor pointed out that a lot of the academics who've written about celebrity in the past, he said it quite politely, but I think basically his point was, they haven't really met any famous people, and that might have affected, or not very many in any case, and that might have affected how they saw it, whereas, of course, his one-hour interviews are really ended up focusing in the main on what is fame, how do you feel if you're considered a celebrity, and what is the downside of it.
They certainly have met celebrities as well, everyone from Kermit the Frog to David Starkey, I think, is mentioned in that interview. I'm not sure what range of people that is.
Johnny Rotten in between.
Johnny Rotten in between. Do check it out on our podcast page. Finally, David, we've got you along because it is your sort of last appearance before you leave the THE, but you've been doing some work which we'll see the fruits of in a couple of weeks' time about the independence referendum in Scotland, obviously pretty current, the TV debate fresh off the air.
It's going to have to be a bit of a tease, of course, because we can't reveal the results, but we've had a fantastic...
You do, of course, know the results of the referendum already.
I do. So you have to judge from my tone of voice. We've had over 1,000 people respond, which is not giving anything away to reveal that, which is brilliant.
And these are all, we should say, these are all employees of
they're
Scottish
all staff, academic and administrative staff at Scottish universities, giving their views on how they'll vote in the referendum, which is, of course, one question. But then also the slightly different question of what outcome they think would be best for Scottish universities, whether it'll be independence remaining in the UK, or whether it just won't make any difference, or in fact, or if they're not sure. I mean, it's a very tough question. I wrote a feature on this a couple of months ago, actually, where it's so difficult to peer beyond 2 years after negotiations. Really, if Scotland went independent, it's very hard to know. So we've had a fantastic amount of response on that. I think more than 80% of the people who responded actually gave pretty fulsome reasons about why they were going to vote how they were and what they believe for Scottish universities. So it's been really good. Unfortunately, the poll is now closed. We're sort of digesting the results, but I'm sure if anyone wants to get in contact with their views, we'd be happy to receive them as we come up to the referendum on the 18th of September.
Absolutely. Well, before we go, David, you've been on the THE for 3 years. Any highlights from that time? Not low lights, please. We're an upbeat show.
Well, I don't know if this counts as a highlight or a low light. What's the weird... When I joined, I did not expect to get a call from Max Clifford. That was one of the strangest things that's happened. did a story about a head of London school, London College of Communications, who's hired in Mr. Clifford, a publicist, now obviously in prison. He'd been brought in to help after we wrote a story about her, and we wrote this story saying, "Oh well, you've got in Max Clifford to help you," and I received a call from Mr. Clifford, who was not best pleased about the tone we'd taken. It sort of seemed to think we'd implied that he wasn't quite good enough to be moving in the higher education circles.
The rarefied circles of higher education.
It's fair to say he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder, or whether he does this for all of his clients and sort of monsters the journalist who's written stories.
So he's not doing
anyway,
it.
She was, the head in question he gave advice to was suspended a few weeks later, so not great advice, clearly.
There we go. Thanks, David, and all the best. We wish you well. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. You can get us on timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. We're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we're on Google+, all the usual places. Do get in touch if you've got anything to say about the issues we've discussed, or indeed any of the issues covered in this week's magazine. That's all for this week's Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.